four-unit that sustains a family unit.
I'd like to call to order the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee. A couple minutes late here, getting started. To begin with, I'd like to have someone make a motion to approve the minutes from the February 8th meeting. Representative Vogel moves the minutes. Any comments, corrections? Hearing none. All those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes are approved. Today we have a number of testifiers coming before us, faculty and students, and the order that I have, I guess, includes the Minnesota State Colleges and University faculty. Don Larson, to begin with. Welcome.
Welcome.
And is this Monty that's coming behind you? Okay. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
And please identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair Nornes and committee members, for having us here today. I'm Don Larson. I'm a faculty member at Minnesota State University, Minnesota, entering my 30th year, but I'm currently serving as the president of the IFO interfaculty organization, which represents the state university faculty in the MinSCU system.
Monty Butte, I teach at Metropolitan State University and also representing the IFO today.
Okay, welcome to both of you.
Well, welcome. Yeah, you have some handouts, I believe, distributed, just two brief sheets of some points we hope to focus attention on, and a chart that you may be familiar with from some other testimony. I know you've heard from MinSCU officials, Bush Foundation, other people who've come before you. Just a very brief introduction to our organization, the IFO. We have actually existed as an organization in name since 1938, back when I think the schools were still called normal schools, and when the state university system was formed in the early mid-70s, we became the collective bargaining agent representing the faculty in those seven state universities: Bemidji, Metropolitan, Minnesota State, Mankato, Minnesota State, Moorhead, St. Cloud, Southwest, and Marshall, and Winona State. We represent almost 4,000 faculty statewide, including part-time faculty, librarians, counselors, coaches, which comes out to about 3,000 full-time equivalent faculty. And our faculty teach more than 80,000 students across those seven universities. I'm not going to go into depth on the chart that I gave you, which comes from the study made very recently, just released this summer, by the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. But as you've probably heard before, Minnesota is going to need an even more highly educated workforce than it already has in just a few years. And it's going to rank third in the nation in total educational need, with at least 70% of all jobs requiring some post-secondary education, and fifth in the nation in terms of requirement for bachelor's degrees. And a substantial portion of those bachelor's degrees, a third or more, are going to be coming from the state universities. At the same time, as you're well aware, the state's share of support for higher education in general has been falling dramatically over years and years. We can't blame that on any one administration, any one party. The truth of the matter is that public higher education is one of those few government services that actually has a separate income stream, namely tuition from the students. And so while the state's share of support for higher education has fallen, we've seen tuition rising. And currently, from the stated legislative promise of funding two-thirds of higher education, the state share is now 45%. In the meantime, the students are, for the most part, being asked to make up the difference. At the same time, we have been coping, as you know, with a number of budget cuts and changes. Actually, I've been at Mankato for 30 years. The very first year I went to a convocation, Margaret Preska, the president at that time, said, we have a budget crisis. We need to tighten our belts. We need to do more with less. And I think there have been at least half of our convocations where one president or another has said, we need to tighten our belts, we need to do more with less. I have yet to hear a president say you can loosen your belts. This is an ongoing trend, I'm sorry to say. But the situation has become especially dire, not just in this pending budget deficit that we're looking at for the next 2 years, but even for the last 2 years or more. And it was in recognition of that that the IFO became the first state employee union 2 years ago to voluntarily put a freeze on our contract at that time. We still do have some increases for promotion and career steps, but basically 85% of our faculty statewide have had no pay increase for the last 2 years. We realize, looking in these years to come, money is still going to be very tight. At the same time, we've worked with administration in the system office and on our individual campuses. You probably know that Chancellor McCormick vowed to leave a clean slate for his successor, Dr. Rosenstone, who will take over as chancellor this summer. And so we've seen drives by faculty administrations at our local campuses to reorganize, to reorder, to find other ways of working academically as well as administratively. And that's, we have tried to work with that. We've tried to work with our administrations to make that as fair and objective and data-driven a process as possible. And that's been painful. Even though outright retrenchments, that's layoffs of tenure track and tenured faculty, have been reduced at Mankato and St. Cloud because of early retirement incentives, we're still having a large number of faculty jobs walking out the door by this May and by May of 2012. By our estimate, we'll be losing about 80 positions at Mankato, another 80 at St. Cloud, 37 positions at Moorhead, another 30 at Bemidji, and combining retirement incentives, attrition, other things at the other campuses, we're expecting to lose up to 10% of the faculty positions that we have now. About 300 positions are probably going to be going out the door by the end of the next academic year. Even the Office of the Chancellor has been cutting substantially in its expenses as well. So our message and our request to your committee, to the legislature, is the IFO has shown its willingness to do its part, to make sacrifices where necessary, to work with administration in constructive ways, and we ask that that effort be recognized. It would be a terrible blow to the morale of faculty to say, you've already worked this hard to make some significant sacrifices, now you're going to be cut even more, we simply ask for that level of recognition from, as I said, the committee and from the legislature. And I'll thank you for your attention. I'll turn things over to Monty Butte, but I know we'll both be happy to take your questions when that is appropriate.
Good afternoon. Right.
Welcome. Identify yourself, too, for the record, please.
Monty Butte, Metropolitan State University, speaking on behalf of the IFO. It's good to be back and see so many familiar faces. Those of you that are new, I hope to get to know you before the session is out. I did notice that you've made one change since the last time I was here. You've rearranged the deck chairs on the Titanic here. Joking aside, the ship of state, our ship of state, is truly sailing into and is floundering and is moving into turbulent water. All of us here today, those giving testimony as well as legislators, are defending our own interests. And that is it should be in the legislative process, the heart of the legislative process. But I would like to use my time to suggest that there may be a greater good that transcends the narrow interests that each of us are defending. We operate in an environment where starkly polarized opinions about how to solve this budgetary crisis dominate the discussion. However, there seems to be unanimous agreement on one position. From the business partnership and the Chamber of Commerce to the AFL-CIO and the Citizens League, there is consensus that the key to the prosperity and well-being for the state of Minnesota and its citizens is an educated workforce. Like public safety and transportation, higher education has long been considered a public good. And from 1960 to the year 2000, governors and legislatures treated it as such. Unfortunately, during the last decade, that heritage has been repudiated. The previous governor and successive legislatures began treating higher education as a private good. Substituting student aid for state appropriations has been a cruel shell game for the current generation of students. Some of you have been around long enough to know in the early 80s, the state's share of public higher education was still 80%, with students picking up the other 20%. For the next two decades, the state's share was roughly two-thirds of that cost. Since 2002, public college students and their families have been swamped by a tuition tsunami. Commitment to sharing college costs by the state of Minnesota has shrunk to 43%. Students at state universities are far more likely to be from moderate and low-income families who struggle to make ends meet. They work far too many hours, usually at low wages, take more credits than they can handle, and given the state's tuition policy, they end up with debt that seems as insurmountable as that of the federal government. In Minnesota, quality education should not be limited to the well-to-do. My days as a citizen activist and a public servant are numbered. As some of you on the committee know, I'm in a losing battle with a rare and terminal cancer. That harsh reality causes one to reflect on his or her life. I grew up a farm boy in southwestern Minnesota. My parents were high school dropouts who eked out a living on an 80-acre farm. College was not on our radar screen. Given that background, how did I become a college professor? Simply put, I had access to high quality and reasonably priced public education. In today's climate, it's highly unlikely that I would have been able to take those first tentative steps at a local junior college that the representative now has connections to. Now, whatever contributions I have made during the past 40 years to the public good of this state, I owe a debt of gratitude to those visionary political leaders of the 1960s and 70s, whose long-term investment in my generation's higher education continues to pay high dividends for the state. I ask state legislators today to do no less for our children and for our children's children. Thank you.
Thank you.
The handout, by the way, a number of the references and numbers are in condensed form here. You can see the transformation since 1981 to present. We're open to questions.
Members have any questions of our testifiers? Representative Rukavina?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Thanks to both of you for coming. And Monty, it's always a pleasure to see you. You know, I kind of have the same background as you, although my parents did graduate from high school, but they kind of eked out a living too. And it certainly was the help of the higher education system and the fact that the state used to pay for two-thirds of the cost that I got a higher education. But in your comments about the positions that are going to be cut by the end of the year, I'm just curious, I don't know if Don or Monty, mm-hmm. which one you want to answer it. Are they going to be replaced with adjunct professors? Are they not going to be replaced at all? What's the effect going to be on students? Is it going to take more time to graduate because they can't get the classes in sync, whatever?
The broad answer is that we're going to see a combination of effects. We're going to see, we already know, certain programs are being closed. We know that sections of classes are not going to be offered, and therefore we're going to see enrollments and seats in those classes having to take up bigger room. And in many cases, our universities do not have the physical spaces, the classrooms that are large enough to fit some of those classes. So either some other combination of technology or other means is going to have to be done to accommodate those students. In terms of adjuncts and part-time teaching, if a position is actually being retrenched, if the tenure track and tenure faculty member is actually being laid off, those cannot be replaced by part-time or contingent faculty. But in the cases where we're seeing some vacancies through retirement, some of those might be temporarily replaced, but these are real cuts. The amount that are going out at the campuses that I cite here, these are actual positions and dollars that are being placed, that are being planned for by the campuses to meet the budget deficit estimates. And so, again, if some of the proposals that I know have been going around for even further cuts to the system should come to bear, we're going to see even more positions going out the door, even bigger classes or fewer students who can be accommodated.
Mr. Butte?
To reemphasize, if these cuts take place, our appropriation for the Minsky system will be the same as it was in 2001. We are now serving the equivalent of 40,000 more students than we had in 2001. There has been, national reports have shown that Minsky and the state universities in particular have been one of the most efficient and least costly per student in the country. We have been productive in a way that if a Fortune 500 corporation could show that, it would make headlines in the Wall Street Journal. You wouldn't believe how we're doing more with less every year, but we've reached the wall. We can't do any more. And another cut is going to start hindering young people from getting the education they need to serve in this workforce in the future and coming times.
I'd add to what Monty just said, that those 40,000 students that have increased over time is equivalent to the current enrollment of St. Cloud and Mankato and about half of Winona. So it's a tremendous amount. Again, doing a lot more with a lot less.
Anything further from Representative Riccobino?
Not for now.
Not for now. All right. Then we'll move on to Representative Demke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both of you for coming and talking to us. This is a very important meeting, and it's very good that we hear from you. Since you mentioned the 43,000 students that you service, and thank you very much for your fine service to these students, could you tell me what percent of those students are in-state versus out-state?
I don't have those exact numbers, but I know the tremendous majority of students are in-state. You'll see more out-state students probably crossing the border from Wisconsin into Metro or Winona, or from North Dakota into Moorhead, but it works both directions. Moorhead, for example, is to some degree in competition with North Dakota State. So it does flow in both directions. I'm sorry, I don't have more specific information than that right now.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up question. Thank you very much. And do we charge the same amount of tuition for the in-state students as we do the out-state students?
There is tuition reciprocity between the two states, and again, I don't have the exact details, and that affects not just Minsky, but students in general. So if students who might choose from Minnesota might choose to attend the University of Wisconsin, or Wisconsin students who come to attend the University of Minnesota do get reciprocity, and that's about all I can tell you right now.
Members, we do have a lot of other testifiers. We need to move on as rapidly as we can. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also appreciate the fact that you've come today, Professor Larson and Professor Butte. It's always good to see both of you. Professor Butte is a person who began his collegiate career at the community college I represent, which is Riverland now, but once upon a time it was Austin Junior College, so it's always good to see you. I wanted to discuss a little bit the the sadness I feel for losing, you know, 10% of the faculty positions. I think that that is just a tremendous loss for the state. When we've had faculty who have gone through, probably most have gone through our system itself to get to the position that they're at, to then be sent back out and not be able to continue on in that position. And the other piece of that for the students not maybe having access to those faculty and those classes, to then also have such an increased debt and amount of tuition costs for those students, that it's going to be difficult for them to then choose the public service that you have chosen to come back into the ranks to be a faculty member. And I'm just concerned about that, and I appreciate your comments on that.
Well, thank you, Representative Poppe. I really appreciate that question, because when I was faculty president at Mankato the last 3 years, and especially last year, as we were doing our part about planning for these cuts, those 80 positions, we saw senior faculty, and these are not the people that you hear referred to as deadwood or as people who've kind of passed their prime. These are very active teachers and scholars, people who are leading study abroad programs, people who have been tremendously dedicated to the institution and their students for years and years, and saying, if there's no other recourse, I will take the sacrifice. I will retire now. I wasn't planning to retire for another year or two, or maybe 10 years, or maybe never, because I love what I'm doing. And we literally saw people in tears over those decisions. Some people who were retiring earlier than would have been advisable for them for economic circumstances, but saying, if this is the only way to save my program, this is the only way to protect the job of a junior faculty member who is just getting started here and who has energy and idea for those new programs, then I will take that hit myself. I will bow out. And it was a very painful process for many of these, and I know it's going to continue to be a painful process. So when we talk about the incentives, it's wonderful that they're there. We're glad that we're able to offer them to those senior faculty to take advantage of, but it's not by any means an easy process for them either.
Realizing that cuts have to be made, I would just ask you to consider that there are some areas of the budget that cuts appear as a wise choice. But I would suggest in higher education, this proposed cut is penny wise and pound foolish. You're literally endangering the future prosperity of the state. We only have, they say we need 70% of our workforce to have post-secondary education by 2018. We today only have 48%. And we are now saying to a lot of citizens in this state, young citizens, the door won't be open for you to get that post-secondary education. We really are hitting the wall here. There are the interests of faculty, etc., but I reiterate to you, there is a greater good here that transcends the interests of any of us when it comes to higher education.
Thank you very much.
And I should just say, we could sit here and talk all afternoon, but we have other colleagues from the faculty at the two-year colleges and the university, and students, of course, who really need the time to make their say as well. So if you have other questions, we can entertain them, but otherwise we're happy to defer to
them. I think
we
need to move on. I appreciate your testimony this morning.
Thank you very much.
Damon, are you, is it Kapke? Is that how you pronounce your last name?
For the record, my name is Damon Kapke, as in Cap and Key, and my mother barely graduated from high school, and my father I'd rather not even talk about. I am a Minnesota State College faculty vice president for liberal arts and an English faculty member from Lake Superior College in Duluth. Representative Nornes and members of the committee, on behalf of Minnesota State College faculty, I want to thank you for this opportunity to share with you some of the great things that we are doing on our campuses. MSCF represents about 5,000 faculty members. About half of them are in the area of liberal arts and transfer educators, which I am, and about half are career technical and occupational educators. In our visits with members of this committee and many of your colleagues, we have come to the conclusion that some of you would benefit from a snapshot of some of the things that we do in our colleges. And so today we've asked a couple of our faculty members to come and talk about some unique programs and things that they are doing. We ask that you listen as if you were prospective students or parents of students who want to learn about what faculty do and what our programs have to offer businesses in Minnesota. At the end of our presentations, we'll be available to answer any questions. At this time, I'd like to introduce Jennifer Satti, who is here to talk to us about court reporting careers. She comes to us from Anoka Tech.
Hi. I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you. I'm the program director at Anoka Tech. We have several careers that encompass court reporting. Real-time reporting is the person who is writing on the steno machine, and we are writing in shorthand. And what we do is we accurately take down the spoken word and put it to text instantaneously. So we've evolved a long way. The current technology is someone can talk instantly, you can see it on the screen. So the new careers that have evolved besides just the courtroom are the captioning and the cart. Your picture here shows a captioning student. You actually have several options as a real-time reporter. One of the options is the traditional freelance court reporter, where you would work as an independent contractor and you would go to the attorneys, law firms, and take down depositions. The other, of course, is the official court reporter, where you would work in a courtroom with a judge. And then the captioning field, which has opened up, there's legislation requiring, mandating TV stations to caption programming. And there's a cart provider. They are meeting the ADA reasonable accommodation. So a cart provider would set up next to someone who is hard of hearing or deaf and then write the written word to write to the text, and they read and follow along instantaneously. So it's an amazing career. We didn't have time for me to do the demo, and that's why you got the picture. But if you ever would like a demo, I would love to show you, because it's just amazing to see someone talk. Right away, the words are on print. We have helped the courts become more efficient. We're able to, the judge, the law clerks, attorneys are able to read instantaneously if they need to go back and refer to prior testimony. It's right there at their fingertips. We are keeping up with the current technology. So at our school, we teach top-notch technology. All of our instructors in our program have the highest certifications possible for court reporters and captioners. We include the industry. They are very helpful. They're on our advisory board, and they help advise in setting up the program and the courses that we offer. So we're training reporters. We're training students, graduates, to go into the professional careers. So they walk out, and they can earn $40,000-$60,000 a year. They can also be their own entrepreneur and start their own business and make six figures. The skies, they really have options out there as far as income. They can work, they have flexibility as well. They can work from their home. They're a captioner. Captioners are sitting at home in their pajamas. They're getting live feed. They're watching the shows on TV. They're getting live audio, and they're sitting there sending it back to the TV station, thus putting it on air. The legislature is captioned, I'm sure you know, on the Minnesota Channel, and we actually have a graduate right now mentoring and interning with the firm that does your captioning. We are the only school in the state, so we are producing the graduates that are filling the courts here that are captioning. We provide opportunities for people who live in rural areas. They can train here, they can move back to, you know, whatever area they want, and they can caption from home. I mean, they can have a legitimate full-time career and actually stay in the community of their choice. We also retrain veteran reporters. So we have a lot of reporters who come back, and they take some of our classes to retrain, learn the new technology, which is the real-time. I am also called quite often, and some of our other instructors, as experts in the field, because we stay current in the technology, and the industry knows that. So we are really answering the bulk of the questions that are coming in about what's new out there, what can we do. I actually have a meeting later this afternoon to show the judges the new wireless steno-read technology that's out there. So we're very involved in the field. We have a 95% placement rate, so our graduates are getting hired. We've got a lot of jobs out there. Nationwide, there's a demand for court reporters. So we're placing them. Oh, yeah, we write 225 words a minute. That's usually impressive.
Wow. Thank you very much, and accurately, too.
I can't
too.
Even think that.
I don't.
I'm sorry?
What?
I can't even think that. It's unintelligible.
I don't remember watching a closed caption where you see somebody backspacing to correct spelling, so
that's right.
Pretty
and,
important.
And, you know, yeah, and that's live. I mean, the captioners are sitting there, and so once in a while, have heart and say, okay, you can see a mistake once in a while because they're live, and picture yourself if you had to sit down and type, and, you know, how perfect could you be? So they're pretty good, though, the captioners up there.
Okay, any questions? Do you have another testifier with you?
We do. We do.
Is that Ken?
Yeah, next I would like to introduce Ken Ryan, who is from Alexandria Technical and Community College, and he's going to talk to us about mechatronics as if we need any real explanation of mechatronics.
Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Ken Ryan. I'm the director of the Center for Applied Mechatronics at Alexandria Technical College. Mr. Chair, thank you for an opportunity to tell you about what it is we do at a two-year institution, Alexandria Technical and Community College, to prepare graduates for the workforce here in the state of Minnesota. My cross to bear, as I mentioned to someone else, is to try to get everyone else to get their head around the term mechatronics. And so I'll begin with that. If you take the word mechatronics, you'll find in it mechanical, electronics, and informatics. We sit at the junction of the three engineering technologies of mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, and information technology. We also are integrated vertically. If you look at the technology that we deal with, you will find engineering at the top. Below that, you will find technologists, and below that, you will find technicians. So we're essentially the clutch in the vehicle that takes engineering principles and applies them to solutions for manufacturing, agriculture, mining, transportation, energy, building automation. If it thinks, we do it. All right? So that's where we live. What we do is in our two-year program, we prepare technicians and technologists, but primarily technologists, to interpret what engineers do at a four-year level in terms of design of automated systems, and then we implement those systems, and then at the technician level, we maintain those systems. I have a couple of vignettes that might let you get a little bit of a sense of what our graduates do here in the state in particular. This example comes from our company in our backyard in Alexandria. Some of you may be familiar with Douglas Machine Corporation. You may also be familiar with the fact that 5% of the automated high-speed packaging machines that are produced in North America are produced in and around the Alexandria area. That's a cluster activity within Minnesota that's a very viable economic component of what we do in manufacturing in the state. I'll just quote for you an article that comes from a recent Minsky publication. 2 years ago, when Brent Erke and co-workers at Douglas Machine Incorporated in Alexandria started a spin-off company, he knew he would need skilled workers. But he wanted more than traditionally trained electricians, mechanics, and programmers. You can't be one-dimensional when you're in a startup company, Erke said. We're looking for people who wear multiple hats, and that's exactly what we found from the graduates at the mechatronics program at Alexandria Technical and Community College. Six graduates are now employed full-time at Douglas Scientific, which produces laboratory equipment that greatly speeds the process of analyzing genetic material. This is just one small vignette, but it gives you a concept of where our students are employed, where, as I said, they are the critical clutch in the vehicle of economic vitality for the state in manufacturing. The engineers dream it, we do it. Okay, and it's as simple as that. And we also maintain it once it's done. The other vignette I'd like to introduce to you is another company that is headquartered here in the Twin Cities. It's Beckhoff Corporation. This is an international corporation that chose the Twin Cities for its U.S. headquarters simply because of the fact that we had trained technicians that knew exactly the type of mechatronic technology that they were implementing in North America. They have 80 employees in the United States at this time. 12 of those are direct graduates from our program. They are the heart and soul of the technical support of that company. And they're why they're in the state of Minnesota and not somewhere else, is because the two-year institution that supports those technicians is here as well. I'd be happy to take any questions if I can clarify things for you.
Did you tell how many students are enrolled in that program?
Yes, we currently have about 65 students enrolled across 2 years. Traditionally, we can handle anywhere from 50 to 75 students. Our placement rate is 400%. I can't possibly produce enough graduates to fill the need. If you look at those employees that we're going to be needing in the future, that we're just we said 70% of those need a technical or need an education. A huge number of those need technical educations. This is the workforce of tomorrow that everyone's talking about. These are the technical skills that are needed for that workforce.
What would be the entry level compensation for a graduate?
Mr. Chair, again, it goes across the board, but I can look a parent directly in the eye and, in all honesty, say that the average would be $40,000 to $60,000 as a starting salary, and depending on what area, as you saw, this is a very ubiquitous field. What area you go into, it's possible to within 3 to 5 years be earning over $100,000. But those are anecdotal. I'd say that this is a tremendous living wage that these students earn. It's very easy for them to earn $40,000 to $60,000 upon graduation from a 2-year program.
Representative Demke, you have a question?
Demke?
Oh, Detmer, I'm sorry. I'm looking the wrong way. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Ryan. Again, you sent me an email, and there's a website that members of the committee could take a look at just to see the Megatronics program and how you are connected with students across the state. Mm-hmm. Could you just maybe send that email to the chair here and get it out to the people, because it's about an eight-minute video that's really worth watching. So, thank you.
Representative Benson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I work at a really small Christian college, and the bulk of our students are in vocational ministry. But I know that in the time that I've been there, that when we've seen a decline in a certain area and we see a growth in another, quite often we'll say, is that a program that needs to continue, and shouldn't we use the resources that we need because we don't have state funding? Or shouldn't we devote the additional? And it just seems to me kind of like a duh thing. If you've got a program that could grow by 400%, does that ever come into play? Do people look at some programs that maybe are not flourishing or not well populated, maybe not as relevant, and say, you know, this is a money maker not only for the state, you know, but for the institution?
Mr. Ryan,
Mr. Chair, are you directing that to me, Representative?
To either.
Oh, I'll let you take that.
To that, I would say that that it can be hard to know exactly which programs are going to lead to that success, and there are peaks and valleys with every program. Within our system, what we do is we work very hard to identify programs that are having some difficulty, and we work with those programs along with business and industry to figure out ways to make them more relevant, and that's an ongoing and constant process. So I think that there certainly is talk of these successful standout programs and thinking on how to capitalize on that. But sometimes it is finding something that goes along with that program, not necessarily doubling or tripling a particular program. Although I think the conversations are all over the place on that.
Representative Benson.
Just to follow up. So then it's pretty difficult to eliminate programs that may not show some real fruit, so to speak, in terms of number of interest in students. So It is hard to move resources and money around to programs that are like the one we just heard of that could just grow.
I don't know if I'd characterize it as hard to do. I think it's an ongoing process of figuring out where to put those resources, and it is something that is looked at on our campuses every year, and always with the cooperation and assistance of business partners. Because we are not merely producing students, we're producing those workers for those industries, and we want to make good decisions, smart decisions, and that means partnering. We're all much smarter when we work together.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd like to add to that.
Mr. Ryan.
One of the aspects of our program is we are the Center for Applied Mechatronics rather than just a program within a technical institution. The reason for that is that we actually have two missions. One is to train our incoming students, and the other is to train the incumbent workforce in these rapidly evolving technologies. And so a lot of the solution for us is is creative partnering with business and industry. We have to maintain our relevancy by constantly being at that interface with industry so that what we're teaching our students is not yesterday's technology. It's not even today's technology. It's tomorrow's technology. And so one of the most, I think, dynamic programs that ever came out of the legislature and out of DEED was the ability for us to do RFP operations with our industry folks. When we could say the legislature or through the legislature, DEED has put, let's say, $20,000 here, and they're looking for requests for proposals for dynamic, innovative ideas for partnering with industry. They stepped up to the plate every time with matches, double matches, triple matches. Those are very highly leveraged dollars, and I would say that if you protect anything in this process, it'd be the ability to reach after those kinds of partnerships. So.
Thank you for your testimony, I believe. Yep. Okay, one quick question. We have other testifiers we have to get to. So
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question. I work at a community college in southern Minnesota, and I know that our career technical areas do have advisory boards that are the business and industry people that are there to help to lead the pathway and what the next needs are. And I was just, you maybe have sort of mentioned that, but I just wanted to make sure. I would assume that perhaps you as well would have an advisory board.
Mr. Chair, Mr. thank Ryan. You, Representative. That's exactly right. We have both state, national, and international presence on our advisory committee.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Again, thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have Andrew Spaeth.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
And Amanda. Yes, Representative Rookie.
Chair, if I could just make a comment,
Yes, you may.
And you're the chair, and you can do whatever you want. You got the gavel, but. It's a little disheartening. The other day that we gave a full 2 hours to Ms. Hegard and Mr. Hutchinson, and now we've got all these different teachers and that representing these different students, and we're cramming them into one little session. That does disturb me, because I'd much rather listen to these people for an hour each different group or two than to listen to Hegard and Hutchinson tell us all. Smart they are and the great ideas.
They won't appreciate that very much, hearing you say that.
But I'm on the record saying
yes,
it.
You yes, are. So. In response, I guess, we will have other opportunities, hopefully, to continue the dialogue with the institutions and the students. But we are trying to hear from as many as we can today. So, Andrew, are you going to be the beginner or the first up?
Yeah.
Please identify yourself then for the record and proceed.
Andrew Spaeth.
And welcome, by the way.
Thank you, Chair and Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andrew Spaeth. I'm a student at Bemidji State University, and I am the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association.
I'm Amanda Bardonner. I'm the student government president at St. Cloud State University, where I'm majoring in international business and marketing, and I also serve on the board of directors for MSUSA.
Okay. So thank you for the opportunity to present before you today. MSUSA represents over 75,000 students attending the state universities in Minnesota. As Dr. Larson mentioned, that includes Bemidji State, Winona, Southwest State and Marshall, St. Cloud, Moorhead, Metropolitan State University here in St. Paul. MSUSA was established 44 years ago in 1967 as an independent, nonprofit organization funded and operated by students. Today, the Minsky Board of Trustees recognizes us as a leader in the system and is the sole representative of the state university students. At the system level, our organization represents student interests on a wide range of issues, including financial aid, academic policies, and project planning. State university students and the MinSCU system are uniquely positioned to help the state weather these tough economic times. Together with the two-year institutions in MinSCU, we produce over 60% of the graduates coming out of Minnesota. 80% of those students stay and work in the state. These are the future business leaders, entrepreneurs, engineers, and nurses that we need. Our state university students are not asking themselves what we need to do to become competitive. Instead, we are asking, how can we continue to push towards excellence and push our system to become the most innovative, creative, and highest quality in the nation? Our students have embodied that message in our budget recommendation regarding the state appropriation. This year, for the first time in our association's 44-year history, our budget recommendation includes a transformational fund, a fund dedicated to the long-term fiscal sustainability of the MinSCU system. difficult decisions will be made this session, but we must plan ahead. Minnesotans do not want us to fix the $6.2 billion deficit by sacrificing our children's and grandchildren's future. In 1980, the state funded 80% of higher education costs. It is no coincidence that 31 years later, in 2011, Minnesotans have more Fortune 500 companies per capita than any other state. The Best Buys, the Targets, the 3Ms, and the small businesses that are prevalent in our state are due here in part to the highly skilled workforce and the quality of life that we enjoy. Our students, just as you, are concerned about the economic reality of our state's deficit. However, we cannot afford to sacrifice Minnesota's economic vitality and competitiveness by continuing to restrict access to higher education. Today, students pay 56% of public higher education costs in Minnesota. We've seen tuition increases of nearly 100% in the last decade. I'm the oldest of nine siblings. My youngest brother is 7 years old. If we continue down this path, he will pay double what I paid for a public higher education. According to the Office of Higher Education, the average student in Minnesota is graduating with $26,000 in debt. How do we plan on contributing to the economy when we have that on our shoulders? In closing, the students attending our state colleges and universities today are the business leaders of tomorrow. If Minnesota wants to compete in the global market, we need to give our students and our future leaders the opportunity to become the entrepreneurs, innovators, teachers, and caretakers the 21st century needs. Minnesota enjoys the quality of life we have today, in part because of the investments in education our state has made in the past. For every dollar the state spends on the Minnesota colleges and universities, the return on investment is $10.87. Continued reductions in the state appropriation will burden students and burden our state's future economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Again, for the record, I'm Amanda Bardonner. Andrew provided you with a little bit of background of the MSU system in general and how MSUSA fits in. I'd like to provide you with a little bit more detail about my institution and some of the decisions that we've been making on our local campus level. Obviously, as the state faces the $6.2 billion deficit, St. Cloud State University is in the process of implementing many changes to both serve as a cost savings to the university, but also as a way to offer new courses and services to myself and my fellow students. St. Cloud State was in the process of developing an outline for a campus-wide reorganization strategic plan prior to the current budget situation. However, the state deficit definitely pushed the university to act quick and speed up the timeline for the proposed plans for reorganization. A strategic planning committee with constituents from all across campus was developed to review both academic and non-directly academic-related areas on campus. The academic reorganization was a two-part process that involved the review of each degree, both majors and minors. Last spring, the university completed the first half of the academic strategic planning process, and through that process, discussions occurred, and the decision to eliminate 26 programs, which held 135 students, were eliminated. These students will graduate with their intended degree, but the programs will no longer accept any new enrollment into the program, which will make St. Cloud State University no longer to hold those programs. Over the summer and fall semester, the second half of the programs were discussed and several reorganization options were presented to the university community. Three additional programs were eliminated: aviation, general biology, and geography. The decision to eliminate programs was based upon their sustainability and their current programmatic and organizational structure, the student demand, and the market need. And these guidelines were used to justify any additional investment. Several programs were slated for reorganization, and our university continues to discuss that process. Another aspect of the reorganization was the academic reorganization, which looked at course offerings and the program placements. This results in the decision to completely reorganize the structure of which our programs are housed. The university is in the process of transitioning from a five-college system to a more complex four colleges and five schools. The new model, though complex at first, will allow for a decrease in overhead costs and the ability for students and faculty to share resources more efficiently between programs and departments. The third aspect of reorganization was the appraisal of the student service, administrative operating, and academic support areas. The final announcement was recently presented, and implementation of this will begin in the fall. With an increased timeline to reorganize, the goal was to reduce expenses while still providing a high level of education for our students. St. Cloud State University has the largest school in the Minsky system and the second largest in the state. We make up about 10% of the Minsky budget. Knowing that Minsky makes up about 4% of the state's budget, St. Cloud State University projected an estimated potential budget reduction of $21 million in the next biennium. These cuts are on top of a 10% budget cut St. Cloud took in the current biennium. Through reorganization, the university has prepared to reduce the FY12 budget by 9.8 through the reorganization, and another $3.8 billion in budget cuts for FY12 will come from the additional reductions across university lines. Budget reductions mean many things for the students at St. Cloud State and across the system. As we aim to cut costs, immediate implications are shown through reduction in course offerings, larger class sizes, and potentially higher tuition or student fees. Student services such as counseling services, health services, programming, student organizations, and many others will be charged with the task next year to offer the same level of service to students with a smaller budget. At the same time we are cutting resources, our student population continues to rise, making a difficult situation even more trying. State funding for higher education has continued to decrease while enrollment across the system has substantially increased. These implications come at a time when 90% of our student body at St. Cloud State has at least a part-time job, and 64% of the student body is 22 years of age or older. The student makeup is changing. Students are no longer able to work and save money in the summer months to cover expenses during the school year like our parents and grandparents were able to. At St. Cloud State University, the number of students seeking financial aid increased 22% from the last academic year. Student debt and student loans could be the next crisis in this country. If you've not already done so, I would encourage all of you to watch the CNBC special titled The Price of Admission. Though it does not specifically speak to the Minsky system or Minnesota, it outlines the effects of increased student debt on our nation as a whole. As tuition has increased, so have the price of textbooks. This past semester, a fellow student paid the equivalent of her January rent three times, or roughly $1,100, all in one day. One-third of this cost went towards her rent, while the other two-thirds covered the cost of her textbooks. These expenses all arise at once, causing a great deal of stress for the average college student who's just trying to get by. As the economy is still in a difficult state, the cost of attending an institution has become a main decision-making point when students are choosing which school to attend. Minnesota has been and should continue to be a driving force in the field of higher education. Students understand the economic realities of today and have worked with the administrations to cut costs and reform the way that we do business, so services are offered in the most efficient and economically friendly way possible. However, there is only so much that we can cut without limiting the accessibility of education and affecting the quality of education that students receive that makes us competitive in a global market.
Thank you. Representative Benson, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're going to both make fantastic examples of graduates from your institutions and go on and do extremely well. My question is, though, that you talk very impressively about a reorganization effort. What do you think the impetus, what was the reasons behind why they did that?
I think that one of the things that's necessary in any field is to continue to look at what programs do we need, what jobs are we going to need in the future. And at St. Cloud, we really made sure that the programs that we're offering, there will be jobs for, and that that they'll be in high demand as well. Another part of the reorganization is it allows students from multiple degrees to work together and really collaborate. And that's something that, as a business major, I'm seeing as I'm applying for internships, is having that broad-based knowledge is essential. And just a four-year degree is not just a four-year degree, but if you have a four-year degree where you can say, I partnered with, my example is always the science students who are creating these innovative projects, but they don't have a marketing background. So my marketing background and my international business skill, I can help them, and that partnership is really what your higher education is all about, and training you for an actual applicable job.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think you answered my question in the first couple of lines, but thank you.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for being here. And I think you may have touched on a couple things. I just want to make sure I understand. Do you see class offerings going down as programs are shut?
Definitely.
Okay. And you said class sizes you see getting bigger?
Yep.
Okay. Fees going up?
Yes.
In fact, we had the board of, members of the Board of Trustees in here early this session, and what we learned is we could be looking at, or you could be looking at, a tuition increase of approximately 7%, 5% plus what's called the 2% that the economic stimulus had bought down. So the math that we were told, at least on the MSU Mankato campus, was that students could be looking at a tuition increase about $400 to $500. Does that sound in line with what you're starting to hear?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marl, thank you for the question. Absolutely. I think 7% is just in the first year. Over the biennium, it would be more like 12% is the planning numbers that the majority of our state university campuses are using. And that's tough to swallow, especially given the fact that in the last decade we've seen tuition increase by nearly 100%.
Representative Marl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To continue on then, that's money out of your pocket, correct? I mean, that's real money. That's green money, that tuition increase, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, absolutely. It's either coming out of our increased student loans that we have to take out, or it's coming out of our families' savings that we had put together to go to college. So.
Mr. Chair, if I might, you might have mentioned textbooks. Are textbook prices going up or down?
Textbook prices have actually gone up. I think something that's interesting about textbooks is that they always create that new edition. So every time there's a new edition, it's a higher price. So.
If I could have one final question, Chair.
Moral.
We heard in this committee, I think you may have already heard today, that the budget for the system is actually at about 2001 level. But I think, Amanda, you might have mentioned there are more students now. In fact, the total number of additional students would equal the population of Mankato. Mm-hmm. So essentially what the system's trying to do is add Mankato into the system at the numbers that were being spent 10 years ago. Does that sound close to what you've been hearing as well?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Andrew? Representative Morrow, that's exactly correct. I think back to the comments Monty mentioned. Otherwise, if you look at that sheet that the orange sheet in front of you, that does lay out the fact that the system is operating at 2001 funding levels with approximately 40,000 more students in our system.
Members, I'll remind you, we have a number of people who need to testify, so we'd like to keep the discussion. I know we want to all talk, but we need to be also conscious we want to have everybody here testify. So, Representative Banyan.
I could ask a lot of questions, Mr. Chairman, but out of respect, I'll keep it short. I can't let pass a moment to welcome Amanda Bardonner to our committee, a student who I have yet to get in a classroom, but I hope to sometime real soon. So thank you for being here. And I'd like to ask both Andrew and Amanda quite simply, in the process of these reorganizations that we've been witnessing so far, can you describe the degree to which students have had input into that, in the sense that you have, that you really kind of own that reorganization along with faculty and staff on the campuses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, thank you for the question. At my home institution that I attend, Bemidji State University, they're going through what they're calling a recalibration. It's the same thing that the reorganization that St. Cloud State is going through. Our budget problem is only $5 million compared to the $14 million that St. Cloud is trying to cut out. But students are really happy with the consultation process. It's actually written in Minsky board policy that students will be involved in the decision-making process on our campuses, and that process has been going extremely well. Administrators have been reaching out to students, and there's been a dialogue, really a civil discourse between students and administrators about what our priorities are and how we're everything from how we're evaluating programs to specifically why decisions are being made about cuts or how the institution is going to look after the cuts take place.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Andrew, piggybacking on Representative Banyan's question, by the way, they eliminated your program while you were here at the Capitol. But anyway.
Well, then I'll just be here with you.
Andrew, do they actually, I mean, what are the results of your input? Do you get listened to, or are you really at the banquet, or are you just doing the dishes when it's over? What's really being happening to the students?
Mr. Spaeth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, thank you for the follow-up. We feel as though we are really being involved in the decision-making process, and that our feedback is integral in the decisions that are being made. The Board of Trustees takes our comments, our consultation letters that we submit biannually very, very seriously. For example, at Bemidji State University, our Vice President our Chief Financial Officer, actually, is his name is Bill Mackey, and I worked with him last year as the student body president at Bemidji State University to adjust the rate at which we were going to charge students for living on campus, the residence hall rates. We had Linden Hall is a structure on campus that we recently renovated, and so we needed to generate some revenue. Students needed to pay a little bit more to live in this new structure, and we went back and forth on what number would work and hammered the math down, and we ended up coming to a compromise. It wasn't exactly what the administration had proposed, and it wasn't exactly what the students want, but it was in between the two, and so I think that's a real example of the consultation process at work.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair,
Representative Rookie,
Andrew, maybe to you again. You know, you mentioned you had 9 siblings. I thought there was fewer. I knew there was a good brood of you there in space. But do you get the state grant program? Do you get Pell Grants? How much help are you getting through our state grant program and that? And I'm assuming you're probably a middle-class family. Maybe I'm an incorrect assumption, but how much help are you and your
Mr.
siblings going to get?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, thank you. I do. The first 4 years of my academic career, I did receive financial aid. As a fifth-year student, I do not actually receive aid, mainly because I'm only enrolled in 6 credits, and so I'm not a full-time student. But my younger siblings, I have 2 brothers who are attending Mankato, Minnesota State University Mankato, a sister at the community college in Fergus Falls, and another brother at Southwest State. And so because of the fact that we have 4 students enrolled in universities or colleges, we do receive financial aid as a family, very middle class. So,
well, Mr. Chair, members, that's
one good. More question.
I'm glad that it is working out for you, and you know that. Representative Benson did say the correct thing. You both, very good presentation. You both go very far in life. I was worried that you might end up robbing a bank to help your brothers and sisters. So, you know, now it sounds like, you know, you might be okay. So
we thank you. Thank you for being here and for your testimony. We wish we had more time. So.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I'd like Travis Johnson and Samantha and Maureen and Deb. And it would really help if 10 minutes, would that work with your group? Can you condense it down a little bit?
Sure, Chair Norris.
Maybe 11 or 12. But
I think I think we can whip through that. We do have 4 speakers, but I think that we can make that happen for you. So good afternoon again, Chair Norris, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Travis Johnson, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. And with me today are Samantha Potter-Rank on my left, a student from Inver Hills Community College, and then joining us afterwards will be Maureen Wanius, a student at South Central College, and Deb Nelson, a student at Century College. And it's our hope just that we'll be able to provide you with a snapshot briefly of MinSCU's system's impact on students and the challenges facing students at our community and technical colleges with regard to quality, affordability, and accessibility in higher education. With 54 campuses and 47 communities throughout Minnesota, the MinSCU system serves all corners of our state. These institutions are often the driving forces behind local and regional economies, and it's our colleges that will provide the well-trained and highly skilled workforce that Minnesota needs to get our economy back on track. Without a strong MinSCU system, it'll be impossible for the state to meet its future workforce needs or to provide retraining and educational opportunities that so many Minnesota workers need and so many Minnesota businesses are clamoring for. As I'm sure you know, past budget deficits have hit public higher education very hard. Over the last 10 years, as was mentioned, students have paid for the majority of these budget cuts in the form of tuition increases, and they have far outpaced the rate of inflation. Tuition and fees at MinSCU two-year colleges have nearly doubled over the past 10 years. Our schools are the third most expensive on average in the country, and far and away the most expensive on average in the Midwest. Increases in tuition have led to significant increases in student debt. From fiscal year 2009 to fiscal year 2010, student borrowing within the MinSCU system increased 19%. During that same time, the number of students taking out loans increased by 15%, and since fiscal year 2003, the average amount borrowed by a student has increased 53% from $4,400 to about $6,800. The state of Minnesota faces a historic budget deficit, and solving this problem will not be easy. I think what is needed now is a transformation in the way that we structure and deliver higher education so that it's financially sustainable in the long term. We can't simply continue the status quo and hope that things will get better over time. Time and time again, cuts to the system have resulted in higher tuition, more student debt, faculty layoffs, increased class sizes, and none of these things are good for the students or for our state. As you work to determine what the future of higher education will look like, I urge you to keep the system's core priorities of quality access and affordability at the front of your minds. It's been consistently proven that a college education is the thing that allows people to lift themselves up and make life better for themselves and for their families. And with me today are three students who are getting an education for that very purpose. And at this time, I'd invite you to listen to their stories.
Okay, Samantha, would you identify yourself for the record and then go ahead and present?
All right, Mr. Chair Narnes and members. My name is Samantha Potterang. I'm a 17-year-old post-secondary enrollment options or PSEO college student. I go to school at Inverhills Community College in Invergrove Heights. When I first thought of the idea of PSEO, I was terrified. I couldn't imagine leaving all my friends behind at high school. Many questions ran through my mind, like, what if college is too hard? What if I made the wrong choice? What if college is just a waste of my time? I can tell you this, though. College is definitely not a waste of my time. I know I made the right choice. I chose to do PSEO because if I worked hard enough, I could graduate from Inverhills Community College with my associate's degree, as well as high school. I could also earn my associate's degree without paying any tuition. This saved my family a lot of money. I live with my mom and my sister, and our total income is less than $25,000. I figured if I could kick out 2 years of college without paying any tuition, that could save my family tons of money. More specifically, after I graduate, I will have saved nearly $10,000. This was the ultimate selling point for me. During my first semester, I was still anxious, of course. I ate in the lunchroom alone, and I spent most of my time studying in the library. I had no friends at that point, and I honestly thought that I made the wrong choice. Maybe college wasn't for me. That was until someone introduced me to Student Senate and Student Life. I became part of both, and my social life took off. I was getting involved, and I really started to feel like I was belonging somewhere. By attending Inverhills Community College, I was completely transformed. I took on leadership roles, joined clubs, and diversified in my thoughts and beliefs. Not only did I get to personally witness my own transformation, I got to watch the closest people around me transform as well. If none of you have seen that, boy, is it cool. I watched them break out of their shells and excel. They pushed me to move forward, and I pushed them. This isn't the end of the road for me. Thanks to support from my friends, staff, and faculty, encouraging me to finish what I start, in May this year, I will graduate from Inverhills Community College as well as from Hastings High School. One of my favorite quotes from my friends is, "See these two hands? They're going to change the world." And I can guarantee you that that's the case with me. I'm going to continue my education at some university in Minnesota because this is one of the best places for higher education. I'm hoping to get into a four-year university and get into a pre-medical program. If I have my way, I will be a pediatric oncologist, and I will do cancer research as well. I decided to go into oncology because when I was about 12, my mom developed cervical cancer. This is one of the hardest things I've ever had to go through. I'm here to put an end to cancer. Who knows, maybe you'll hear about me in the news for curing cancer someday. I can't achieve this without further education, though, and without state support for affordable, accessible, and quality education. Without this support, fewer students will be trained into the workforce. Without a trained workforce, there are more people depending on the government, and ultimately less taxes are going to be paid. It has a snowball effect. We need to support students of all ages. I can tell you that I'm not someone who comes from a wealthy family. I can tell you that I have 10 plus years of schooling left, and there's no way that I can afford to finish this without going into a lot of debt as tuition continues to rise. If I successfully become an oncologist, I should be in a position to repay the debt I incur, but I am just one student out of the hundreds of thousands out there with ambition to accomplish many great things. They're out there wondering how to pay for college. They are wondering if they should pick up an extra shift just so they can put gas in their car. They're wondering if college is even worth it, just like me. If we keep raising tuition, people are not going to be able to afford it and contribute to the economy after graduation in a significant way, and they won't be able to finish what they start. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we're very impressed with your life goals. If the pages could roll up a couple extra chairs for the other two testifiers, maybe they could all stay at the table in case there are questions. And we have Maureen coming up and Deb Nelson. And welcome. Identify yourself for the
record. I'm Maureen Wanyas. I'm a student at South Central Community College in Faribault, Minnesota. Chair and members, hello, my name is Maureen. I am in the Medical Laboratory Technician Program, phlebotomy, as well as I'm Student Senate President on our campus. I'm here today to talk to you about why I decided to go back to school after 7 years of being away. I decided to go back to school because I wanted to make a better life for myself and my daughter Lola, who is 9 years old now. I was tired of working minimum wage jobs and living paycheck from paycheck. I knew I could do something more with my life, and I wanted my daughter to see how important it was to get an education. After much consideration, I chose South Central College because it was close to home and had the program I was looking for. At first, I just went to school to get it done with and move on to the next phase of my life. But as I got more into the college experience, I realized that college is about more than getting a job. It's also becoming part of your community and learning to grow as a person. I got into the Student Senate in the fall of 2009 as an executive senator and then progressed through the ranks, and now I am president. I have fully enjoyed my time at SCC, but it's hard because I've had to work so much to pay tuition and to support Lola. I have worked in the library at Central College as an assistant to the librarian. I work there about 15 hours a week. I also work at a couple of restaurants in Owatonna. I work three shifts at Pizza Ranch in Owatonna a week and four shifts at Old Town Bagels. I need to work this much because I'm trying to get through school without having to take on more debt than I will be able to pay back. I still have to take out loans to balance it all. But there is a big downside to working this much. My daughter Lola doesn't get to see me as often as she'd like, and that is really hard for me. I've also taken longer to complete my degree because my credit load has varied based on my work availability. I need to work this much, though, because I have responsibilities that I need to take care of. One is which school tuition and books and the rest of the expenses that come along with going to school. I'm thankful that my grandparents are letting Lola and I stay with them while I go to school and so I can save money. But there are a lot of people out there that don't have this luxury. They struggle to make ends meet while balancing school and work, and some of these people drop out and work at jobs that don't go anywhere and improve their situations. That is why I believe you need to think of the students when making your decisions and how to fund the MNSCU system. In the past, cuts to the system have been passed on to students in the form of tuition increases. One of the great things about the MNSCU system is that it is open to everyone who wants an education. But we need your help to make sure that the college is affordable and available to every Minnesotan who wants to improve their life. I struggle to balance work or going back to school with working in life, but I'm willing to go through that struggle because I know at the end things will be better for my daughter and myself. She will not have to live in poverty and will see that getting an education is important to having a good life. I believe that if more people could be to get an education, that the quality of life here in Minnesota would be raised. Educated people get better jobs, lead to more independent lives, and contribute more to their communities. Our colleges will create the educated workforce that we need to get out of this recession and to get our state and our country back on track. Thank you for the invitation to speak here today, and thanks for listening.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. How close to graduating are you?
I'll graduate in May with my AAS degree in medical laboratory technician, and I'll also have my certificate for phlebotomy.
Very good. Congratulations. Next testifier is Deb Nelson. Identify yourself again for the record.
Deb Nelson, and I attend Century College. Good afternoon, Chair Norvis and members. Thank you for letting me speak today. I'm a non-traditional returning student. I attended college when I was younger, but I worked for a petroleum equipment company, and I kept getting promotions, and by the time I was working many hours, I could no longer attend school due to the workload, so I left college and never finished my degree. I took on all the work I could to raise my kids after my divorce, and back then, experience and a good work ethic earned you promotions. That was all I needed, but it's no longer the case. I've learned through experience that, unfortunately, a college degree is not a luxury or an alternative path to success, but a necessity. Prior to December 2007, I was an assistant to the director in a small corporation. Unfortunately, the director unexpectedly passed away, and his heirs closed the company. Suddenly, I was back in the job market, only to find out that without a degree, I couldn't even get an interview. Luckily, I was able to return to school through the Dislocated Workers Program, and so I decided to do that to try to earn a degree so I could hopefully once again find a fulfilling full-time position. Since returning to school, it's reminded me how much I love learning and how much I like to help other people, so I actually have switched to an education major. And I have part-time positions. I direct choir, so I also enrolled in music courses so that I would have the education I needed to keep the choir job that I have, because they also want credentials in that job now. And while there, my counselor actually advised me to also complete my AA degree, since I only need a few more classes to do that, keep my options open. One problem I've noticed that a lot of non-traditional students like me face that makes college more expensive is that due to the number of years you've been out of school, when you take that Accuplacer test, and depending on the student, especially subjects like algebra, it's been a lot of years since high school. It's pretty hard to place into that. So I know I've bought a textbook, and I'm hoping to bring myself up to speed and take all those classes myself, but most students don't do that. I'm not sure if it'll work out, but hopefully it will. I was on track to finish my degree this spring, but this fall I was unfortunately diagnosed with cancer, so I cut back on my credit load, and now I'll have to return in the fall. That means that I'll have spent more than four semesters at a two-year college, unfortunately, so I won't be able to finish my four-year degree in 4 years. If tuition continues to rise, I worry that I'll be able to complete my degree now that it's going to take me more time. I did take out a loan, and at my age, frankly, debt makes me a little bit nervous. I'm not in the same boat as some of these students. I work multiple part-time jobs. I direct a youth choir at one church. I lead child programs at another church. I also do some on-call office work. Try to get my bills paid. I need to earn the degree. I'm hoping that by earning the two-year degree, it'll help me find a better part-time, hopefully one or two part-time jobs while I continue to finish my degree. Otherwise, I'm afraid that I'll be in the same situation I was when I re-entered the job market, overqualified and under-degreed. Being able to attend a community college has really helped me attain an education at an affordable cost, more affordable than if I had attended a four-year college. I've met a lot of non-traditional students like me who've also returned to school because they were laid off. Century College gives us an opportunity to dream that we will once again be in a satisfying position where we'll be producing in the workforce and we'll have the credentials that we need. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, and best of luck to all of you as you finish up your degrees and so forth. Any questions of our group? Representative Rukavino.
Ms. Nelson, is it? Did you, you mentioned the Dislocated Worker Program helped you out, and it's, you know, that's had a lot of pressure put on it. Were you able to stay on that program? Did you run out of money? Or
yes, I did.
Ms. Nelson.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today, and thank you for your testimony.
Are you on conference?
Oh, it's not for them.
Okay, we have a comment. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Poppy. Chair. It's not for them,
so they can go on.
Sorry. Mr. Chair, I just had a question about, you know, one of the students here was talking about PSEO, and I was wondering if it might be possible for us sometime to have a presentation about PSEO and international baccalaureate programs and advanced placement and whatever. I know it's kind of a K-12 thing, but really does impact higher education and the cost for higher education.
I think that's a good idea, and I think we've made note of that, and I have a granddaughter that's been in the program, so it's very good. Next, the University of Minnesota faculty. We, just for the members, we may run a little past our normal 2:15 if you don't mind. If you have to leave, you're welcome. We understand, but we're going to try and give as much time to our presenters as we can, but still trying to move along as fast as we can. So we have challenges to do that. The first person up.
Okay, so,
there is a handout being distributed.
Right. So I'm
Professor Caroline Hayes from the Department of Mechanical Engineering. And with me today are Professor Liz Boyle from Sociology in the College of Liberal Arts, and we also have Professor Emily Hoover, who is in the College of Food, Agriculture and Natural Resource Sciences, but she can say it better than I can. We are all members of the Faculty Consultative Committee, which is the executive body of the Faculty Senate. And so, in particular, Emily Hoover is a former FCC chair, and both Liz Boyle and I are faculty legislative liaisons, which is a volunteer position where our goal is to transfer information and understanding between the faculty and the legislature and vice versa. And faculty governance and this aspect of faculty governance is very important at the U. So we have three missions at the U that make us unique, that combination. So there's teaching, research, and outreach. And these three are very tightly tied together and very much interplay off of each other. So we're each going to talk a little bit about what these three missions, teaching, research, and service, mean in each of our colleges. So I'm going to start out, and we find it best to talk about what we know, so we're going to talk a little bit about our own experiences doing these three things. So teaching, I teach a variety of courses. One I just wanted to use as an example is human factors. This is one I just finished in teaching last fall. I mean, I'll teach it again, but I just finished up that course. So the goals of human factors are to teach people how to design technology so that it works well with people. A big challenge that you may notice that is often not quite done properly because I haven't taken my class. So it's a project-based course with about 50 people, and it's done with a combination of in-class students and distance education students who take the course online. Many of the people who take the course online are working in industry, and they use projects from their or problems from their own company for their projects, and they directly use the principles learned in class to help improve some aspect of the work that they're doing at their company. So then a little bit about research. So again, we all typically are involved in multiple research projects. One I'll give as an example that I'm currently involved in is working with the Veterans Administration. The funding comes from the Veterans Administration. So I'm working with the VA here in Minneapolis, as well as several VA offices in Fargo and in Iowa as well, to bring together knowledge about telemedicine together in one place so that these different units can learn from each other about how to more effectively do this. So this is essentially giving our veterans better access to medical care. Telemedicine is used a lot in, for example, mental health counseling. So you don't have to drive 4 hours, you know, from where you live in rural Minnesota for a half-hour appointment in Minneapolis or in Fargo. This can be done through telemedicine. So it saves a lot of cost, not only for the VA, but for the patients, and a lot of convenience. And it just is a way to bring better access to health care. So, and then lastly, I'm going to talk a little bit about outreach. So one of the outreach projects that I'm working on right now is, in fact, a collaborative project with MNSCU, with, in particular, Itasca Community College, and we are working with Blandin Paper Corporation and also Minnesota Power's Rapid Energy Center. And what we're doing is we are teaching the teachers, you know, basically teaching ergonomic specialists within Blandin and helping them jointly to develop training programs that help their employees to recognize situations where they may incur injury, you know, various sorts of spinal injuries, repetitive stress injuries, and not just that, but how to redesign their processes, their tools, their equipment, so that they can avoid those injuries in the future and live better, healthier, happier lives. I mean, if you get an injury, that doesn't always heal up, and that may be with you for the rest of your life. You know, so this is very serious business. I mean, not only is it costly, it really impacts the people who are involved and who get the injuries. And then lastly, I wanted to talk about how this all plays into contributions to the economy of Minnesota. So at University of Minnesota, and I'm going to speak, you know, mainly for my college or about my college because that's the way where I have the most experience, and my colleagues will in turn talk about their colleges. But we are producing these graduates who understand and embrace high-tech, high-quality graduates. We are also developing cutting-edge research with both a variety of internal, state, and federal funds all leveraged together. And those, in turn, together create jobs and revenue and new startups and the technologies we transfer to companies where we have partnerships. It also helps those companies. And so together that creates economic activity in the state, great economic activity. And so just from our college alone, we have currently about 4,000 active startup companies founded by our alumni with more than 500,000 employees and over $46 billion in annual revenues. So thank you, and I'll pass the floor on to my colleague, Liz Boyle.
Who's next?
Chairman Norinus, members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Boyle, and I'm a professor in sociology. Caroline's given you a broad overview of the College of Science and Engineering, and I wanted to just kind of hone in on a particular example in my couple of minutes to talk about one of the students that I've worked with who embrace the opportunities that are available to all of our bright and enterprising students at the University of Minnesota. And, you know, when you see the students who are speaking today, you really appreciate, you know, one of the wonderful things about being a professor, you know, the ability to work with these kinds of fabulous students. But I wanted to talk about Ahmed Ali, who was born in Somalia. His mother was a refugee who came to Minnesota in the late 1990s. I first met Ahmed when he was an undergraduate student in my sociology of law class. He was majoring in law and criminology, which is a very popular sociology major. Ahmed did very well in the class. I was impressed by his intelligence, but not only that, by his work ethic, and so I invited him to participate in one of my research projects. He worked with three other undergraduate research assistants and two graduate research assistants. I paid their salaries with funding from the National Science Foundation. Ahmed got very interested in the project and decided to apply for funding for a spin-off project of his own. So he applied for funding with the Undergraduate Research Opportunity Program, which provides research opportunities for undergraduates for over 100, I think hundreds of undergraduates at the University of Minnesota each year. And it funds things on everything from water quality to disease prevention to Somali family well-being. Over the following semester, Ahmed conducted numerous interviews and transcribed and analyzed them and wrote a very interesting paper. After graduation, he joined AmeriCorps, and he's now an elementary school teacher in St. Paul. We continued to develop and expand on his paper after he graduated, and it was ultimately accepted in International Migration, which is a peer-reviewed journal. And what it does is it provides an in-depth understanding of the unique pressures that the refugee experience places on families and the consequences of those pressures for family stability, for things like divorce and separations and those kinds of problems. Each of our students at the University of Minnesota, like Ahmed, bring unique experiences to our campus.
We have students from rural Minnesota. We have students from Minneapolis, Chicago, and New York City. We have non-traditional students. Our classrooms are full of military veterans, athletes, sorority sisters, and fraternity brothers. And what these students have in common is they share a history of accomplishment. They've already done some things very, very well, and that is clear when you have the privilege of teaching them or working with them on research. As a faculty at the University of Minnesota, we try to channel the talents and enthusiasm of all of our students to create a vibrant and productive environment where great things can get accomplished. I know from personal experience that our students take this spirit with them when they graduate, and they bring it into the workplace to shape tomorrow's innovations. So thanks very much for allowing me to share that with you today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. And my name is Emily Hoover, and I'm a professor of horticulture in the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences. Tom Rugavine and I go way back. And I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the land-grant mission of the University of Minnesota. And we've talked about teaching and research, and I'm going to also talk a little bit about extension. So I've been on the faculty at the university for a number of years, longer than I like to admit sometimes, and I've had the pleasure and privilege of having not only the responsibilities of teaching our spectacular undergraduates and mentoring graduate students, but I've also had appointments with the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station as well as the Minnesota Extension Service. And because I think I bring a little bit of a different perspective than both Caroline and Liz do, in that I've also had statewide responsibilities as the fruit extension specialist for the state of Minnesota. So I work with the apple growers, the grape growers, the berry growers, and recently we've been spending a lot of time working on high tunnel production, which is basically the ability to cover plants in plastic to avoid some of the problems that we have with our climate. I want to now just attract your attention to the booklet that's being passed out. It's called Minnesota Hardy. The Department of Horticultural Science has 9 plant breeders, and a lot of the products that you see in that particular pamphlet are very visible. So you might have had a Honeycrisp apple developed in our department. You might have planted a Rosy Lights azalea developed in our department. You might have one of the selections of little blue stem called Blue Heaven developed in our department. And those are the really visible attributes of the horticulture department that are fun to talk about. They're fun to give away. People really like them. The Sven, Ole, and Lena roses are quite entertaining, and the jokes are great. But what I really want to draw your attention to is the underpinnings of what that visible research product actually does. It supports undergraduate projects. It supports graduate theses. It also develops small businesses. We're up to almost 40 bonded wineries in the state of Minnesota, all based on the grape varieties that have been released from the program at the University of Minnesota. We have a lot of citizen interest. The whole area of local and organic food production is something that our faculty and students embrace wholeheartedly. And it also allows us to have the research base so that we can apply for the national grants through the United States Department of Agriculture and NEFA, as well as some of the specialty crop research initiative grants that are specifically targeted to specialty crops, which is what our department works on. But without the basic funding for the Agricultural Experiment Station and the University of Minnesota Extension Service, some of those projects will not be able to be supported. The national grants that we now receive will not have that kind of research underpinning that's needed. And therefore, the plants that you see that can survive the kind of chilly temperatures that we experienced this morning, and they can't come inside like we do, won't necessarily be possible. I have numerous roles at the University of Minnesota. I'm a teacher, I'm a mentor, but I'm also a citizen of the state of Minnesota, and I'm very proud to say that I've spent my career as a faculty member at the U. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And I don't know about you, but I get a little spring fever when I look at this book. Representative Rukavina,
Mr. Chair,
and a comment.
All three of these wonderful women do a great job at the university, but I'm interested about my strawberries. It was 37 below and embarrassed this morning.
It was.
That's not wind chill. It was 12 above in Anchorage, Alaska. Mm-hmm. So think about that. And does anything grow in zone 2B? Look what happened to me.
I'm not going to address Chair, Representative Rugavina, I can't help your height issue. I'd be happy to talk to you about how plants can survive given the right protection.
We're going to have a discussion.
Okay, very good. After committee. Okay. I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today, and again for your testimony. I think we now need Matt and Peter to come forward.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, if who's Matt and who's Peter?
I am Matt Forsty. I'll let Peter introduce yourself to.
And I'm Peter Ercola.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Matt Forsty, like I said. I'm a member of the Undergraduate Minnesota Student Association, so undergraduate student government. I'm a freshman at the university, just graduated high school last year. I'm originally from Rochester. And I am planning to major in economics. So today I'll be brief, but I'll try to just give you an idea of what kind of brought me to the university. Maybe I can give you an idea of how the university has affected my life and how I think it'll affect my future and is already affecting my future. I'm going to start by taking us back about a year and a half to when I was just starting my college applications and admissions process and kind of my whole search. To be honest, I was almost completely dead set on what I wanted to do for college, and that was go out of state to a small private university. I thought that was what I wanted to do with my life. I was a little bit to my parents' dismay because they both graduated from the U of M, and my grandparents graduated from the U of M, and I have aunts and uncles and all kinds of family members, so they convinced me that it would be the right decision to look at kind of a wide array of schools, and so they convinced me to apply to the U of M and take a look at the campus and what the U had to offer. And I must say, now I'm greatly appreciative of what they had me do, and obviously I ended up enrolling at the U. As I kind of went through that process and comparing schools, I learned a lot about what the university has to offer and what it kind of means to be a public school student in the state that you grew up in. And I saw that what the U of M can offer is in many areas better and very competitive with out-of-state private schools or private schools in the state and schools that generally have a higher maybe reputation than the U. And that's both in the area of academics and in the area of research and research opportunities, the U greatly surpasses any other university I looked at. And as far as having a vibrant, large campus with limitless opportunities, that was involved in my decision to attend the U also. Another factor was, of course, the financial factor, which is probably the biggest factor for most students, I think, these days when they're choosing where to go to school. And the U was not the least expensive school that I looked at, but it was very competitive, especially compared to private schools and things like that, even with rising tuition. So today, as I said, extremely satisfied with my decision to be at the U. I'm involved in campus life. I feel very, very challenged in the classroom, and I'm getting involved in a number of things. And there's one quick thing I want to highlight, and that's that starting this semester as a freshman, I'm actually involved in research as a research assistant. I don't think you would hear that from freshmen at many other universities, and it's not because I'm extra special, it's because a lot of kids at the U get to do it, and even at a young age. I'm working at the Minnesota Population Center, research assistant there, and that's a project that's housed by the university and funded. So that experience, when I'm just getting started, is helping me. I'm in a professional environment, I'm doing research, I'm preparing myself to move forward into a career, and in addition, that opportunity is helping me because I'm being paid for it, mitigate tuition, which is tough to handle. So that brings me to the issue of tuition, which I'll talk about just briefly before handing it off to Peter, and that's that the first thing I want to say is that I believe firmly that all students should have a stake in their own education. A financial stake, and I do, and I know that almost everyone I talk to these days has a financial stake, and sometimes it's one that's larger than they can handle or will be able to handle. Tuition has risen over 130% in the last decade at the U of M, and of course fees and other expenses have skyrocketed along with that. So I guess what I just want to say in conclusion is that we've got some bang for our buck. We've seen huge increases in quality at the U of M, and we've seen new building projects, and we've seen a lot of new prosperity, and I'm really happy to be a part of that. But I think that to maintain that quality and to keep it affordable for students, I think me and other students would really like and need to see a decline in that percentage increase in tuition.
Peter starts, you have a question of Matt? Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to, Mr. Ford, he's being very humble. In fact, he is a very special student, and I'm very pleased to see he does research. He's been one of our great graduates in Rochester, and I, too, am pleased that he's gone to U of M, and frankly, they're very lucky to have him.
Very good. Peter, you're up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Peter Urkula. I'm a sophomore studying political science and history at the university. I'm here as well representing students at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. I want to talk about problems that students face at the U of M, but before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about the university itself. Because the U of M started having an effect in shaping my life long before I enrolled in the fall of 2009. I was born in St. Paul, raised in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, which is where I call home. My father was educated at the University of Minnesota and eventually received a doctorate in forestry. And ever since I can remember, he's been faculty as well, working at the College of Farming and Agriculture and Natural Sciences North Central Research and Outreach Center in Grand Rapids, which he now heads. And growing up, I was surrounded by alumni and faculty all throughout my family. My mother, my brother, aunts, uncles, cousins, all have been, many of them have been involved with the university, either in getting an education or working there. My earliest memory, I should note, is walking across the Washington Avenue Bridge with my aunt. That's my earliest memory of the university. During high school, I was also keenly aware of the university's presence there. I never participated in the college and the school's classes that my high school offered due to a rigid schedule, but I had a very close friend who did, and he never misses an opportunity to remind me that he's going to be graduating earlier than I am. But the university had a fairly large effect on my life in 2006. When my father was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And it was University of Minnesota doctors at the Prostate Cancer Center that performed his surgery. As I got closer to graduating high school, it became clear to me that the U of M was where I wanted to go. I'd heard all the stories and complaints about the class sizes and the size of the campus and the professors who weren't interested in teaching. But what I found when I arrived here was quite different. My first fall, I had, of the four classes I was enrolled in, two were under 20 students, and only one was over 100. The next semester was similar, and my only class over 100 was, that was probably due to the fact that it was taught by a former Vice President Mondale. That helps illustrate some of the opportunities that are offered at the U. And continuing from what I said before about, you know, the things you hear, students hear when they're thinking about going to the U is issues about the size of campus, issues about professors. I've found professors and graduate students that I've had especially engaging. I've had professors who've had classes with more than 100 students who make a point to learn each student's name and succeed. And what I've found out that my experience with the university isn't unique. The U of M has a positive effect on people's lives, both on campus and across the state. But students now are facing a lot of challenging in pursuing that education and being part of the University of Minnesota. Last year's tuition went up 4.4% for Minnesota residents and 7.5% for out-of-state residents. That's about $600 for resident students and over $1,000 for non-residents. And that's after the stimulus dollars, and so that would have been more if it hadn't been for the stimulus funding that went to the keeping tuition down. And in the last 10 years, tuition for the United States for the University of Minnesota has increased over 134%. This ongoing trend makes it challenging not only for lower income families, but also for average income families to send their kids to college. I agree with Matt absolutely that students should have a financial stake in their college, in their education. I've been very lucky to have parents that make very generous contributions to my education, but not all students are as lucky as I am. And even so, I'm not going to be leaving college debt-free, to say the least. Tuition isn't the only way that cutbacks affect students on campus. We see a very, very clear correlation when funds get cut. We see student fees increase, we see student services decrease, and we see faculty being cut and our class sizes increasing. The legislature obviously has a very serious budget situation and has a lot of tough choices to make. But the choices you make have a serious impact on the university and on university students. I as I said before, I can see the short-term effects of those cuts. I can see them very clearly on my tuition statement and on the fees that I pay. But what I can't see are the long-term implications of those cuts. Minnesota is the place where I want to live after I graduate. And it's my hope that others, my kids, others' kids, have the same experience with the University of Minnesota that I did. A very positive experience that starts long before they're looking at going to college and continues long after. I know the committee has heard these issues raised before, but I think it pays to hear it firsthand from students, and I thank you all for allowing us to speak here today.
We thank you very much. We've heard you loud and clear, and all of you have been very impressive with your presentation, so we applaud you for that. I think at this point, since we're beyond our normal time, unless there's a pressing question, Representative Papia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for you. Next week, we'll be doing the U of M joint meeting for the Regents, and we've been meeting with the Regents. I'm sure all of us have. I'm just a bit curious about the process. If you'd have an opportunity just to describe how that actually works and how we're going to be voting on people and what that's going to be like. It's coming up next Wednesday, I think.
Why don't we... It's a little confusing. Why don't we send you out an email and we'll lay it out for you? It's pretty well set, but you know, there are a couple.
I just don't recall how it works. And
yeah,
how voting
we'll be hearing, you know, from the candidates, and we'll be interviewing the candidates, and then we'll be attempting to take some votes. In short, that's what we'll be doing, and with some recommendations from some of the congressional districts, perhaps, and we'll. But we'll follow it up with a more specific game plan for you. That'd be all right? For all members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I asked the same.
Okay, very good. And our meeting is adjourned.